Radio.
What an opening theme to this great show on Tuesdays, the American Sports History Podcast, hosted by a brother, a friend, and a mentor, Peter Ray. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing this in Los Angeles. 347-205-9631 goes by quick. Catch the archive version on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So more of him, less of me. Let me lay that red carpet down, put the podium in his place, hand off the mic. First of all, Peter, the threes. How are you? How can people get a hold of you? And here comes a great guest again in your nice show.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. The channel name is my name, Peter J. Rea. And you're absolutely right. Tonight's guest has written two amazing books, amazing baseball books. The first, which I have read, is Basis, and very much enjoyed, Basis to Bleachers, a collection of personal baseball stories from the stands and beyond, 2019. The second book I'm almost done reading and also very much enjoying as well, Backyards to Ballparks, more personal baseball stories from the stands and beyond, 2022. Welcome to the show, Mr. Eric C. Gray.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, this is wonderful what you've done. You know, what you've done is you've compiled all these stories, people from baseball fans, and given them a chance to tell their stories of going to games and playing. And the thing that got me as I have been going through the books is their relationships that they had. Especially it was nice when it was like between grandparents and grandchildren or over generations or just loving relationships that baseball had involved. It was very touching and a beautiful story. And first of all, Eric, would you like to talk about these two books overall, and then you can get into reading some of the stories?
Yeah, that would be great. You know, the obvious question or place to start would be, how did I come up with this idea? And it was in 2011, and I was at a ball game with my wife and my daughter and a friend, and I just idly asked the question, so what was your favorite game you've ever been to? You know, what was the favorite moment at a game? And, you know, I went home that night. I thought about my favorite moments. Some of them were being at the game when they retired Mickey Mantle's number. I'm from New York originally, and he was my hero. And another one was being at a spring training game when a photographer came over and took a picture of Dusty Baker with his arms around my kids. And the third was being at a World Series game with my daughter. But I wasn't really thinking in terms of stories. I was just thinking of events. And then I started asking people, and a friend of mine who ironically likes baseball less than anybody I know, I just asked him this question just to give him a hard time because that's what we do with each other. Anyway, Andy wrote me a story that was so personal that I knew that I had to do this book. And I kind of knew from the beginning, Peter, that stories are going to be about far more than I saw a perfect game or I saw a triple play. I just had the sense right away that they were going to be funny stories, touching stories, emotional stories, stories that were going to make people – well, I mean, I didn't really actually know. I couldn't have predicted what I was going to get. But as the stories started pouring in, they were stories that I realized would make people laugh and tear up sometimes and remember. And to this day, whenever I get stories from people, quite often it reminds me of either a story that somebody else sent me or frequently just an experience that I've had in my life. And I ultimately got 1,250 stories from 14 different countries around the world, and 275 of them were in the first book. And 3 years later, the second book is out there with another, 325 stories or so from, again, from 7 different countries in almost every state in the United States.
Yeah, looking at my notes from the two books you had, I liked the part about Corey Kluber's father, Jim Kluber, from Cleveland, thought being so proud of his son, winning Game 1 of the 2016 World Series. Perry Barber, the female umpire. Buck O'Neill, some good Negro Leagues stuff. People going to the Field of Dreams, actual field. Gabe Paul's daughter, Jenny Paul, the Cleveland GM. And then the second book, I love the story of Brett Boone talking about his grandfather, Ray Boone. Ray Boone played for Cleveland. And then the guy talked about, Mazeroski in 60, the only time he saw tears in his father's eyes. Another one, the guy who sang the national anthem, and he was congratulated by Willie McCovey, Ernie Banks, Warren Spahn, and Ted Williams. Wow. And the other, a couple things he talked, one of the guys talked about freezing moments in time. That's how what I think. I look back on my life, and I think about certain years, and that reminds me of a moment in time. And this one I just read about, the love of a grandfather. The guy said he loved his grandfather so much that he ended up loving baseball as a result, since his father did. So, Eric, would you like to start off with one of your stories?
Sure, be happy to do that. One of the things I just want to say is a really completely unexpected result of my doing this book is the number of friends that I've made through this project. I really didn't anticipate this coming. I mean, just a few of the people you mentioned. I'm Jim Kluber. I'm friends with him now. What I like about his story is the way he wrote it. He didn't say who his son was until towards the end. I mean, it's the way the story is put together. Perry Barber, who you mentioned, Perry and I are good friends. She has a story in each book, and she's a professional women's umpire. Because women don't umpire at the major league level, she hasn't done that, although she did in a spring training game. Anyway, she's a terrific people. She's a terrific person, and frankly, a lot of the stories that you mentioned also are people that I've gotten to know. Let me start with this one. To me, this is kind of a perfect story of the time. We're not out of COVID yet, but hopefully we're coming out a little bit. And this is a story from Frank Miller from Dallas, Texas. I just wanted to have a catch. After reading the history of baseball in 10 pitches, with ball in hand, I, a former college pitcher, just wanted to try out some of the grips, the slider, the curve, even though I hadn't thrown a ball in decades. I needed someone who could catch a hard one or one in the dirt. I didn't know anyone who could do that. So like a mother looking out for her kid, my wife, Alice, a baseball fan in her own right, posted on Neighborhood App next door asking for someone who might want to have that catch. The responses started flowing in. A woman called for her son, a couple of guys, all enthusiastic. Another wrote, "What a wonderful way to bring people together and start 2021 with a positive note." Alice, in a follow-up post wanting to make sure the show would go on, suggested a time and place. We showed up early, not really sure if anybody else would. After all, comments aren't commitments, especially when online. I brought some baseballs and an old catcher's mitt, and then people started to arrive. 3 students from the North Dallas High School team came with a staff member, a 26-year-old guy, a 73-year-old man from Queens, New York, and several others in between. There was even a spectator in the bunch, as well as a reporter from the local ABC affiliate. Hellos were said, lines formed, and balls started being thrown in court back and forth like kids at a little league practice. But something more started to happen beyond the catches and misses. People started talking to each other about life, their own lives. Connections were made, perhaps friendships. Time will tell. My new friend, Rich, when asked why he came, simply said, "Fountain of youth. The opportunity to do something I never expected to do again in my life." The first session ended. Some of us were exhausted with tired arms and wobbly legs, having not thrown a ball in decades. But I think it's fair to say that most of us were energized. It remains to be seen if these wannabe stars and old diamond warriors will continue to meet. But important things had happened. People had gotten another shot at past glories. They'd had a chance to do something nice, to usher in a year with a little more hope than the one just left behind. I plan to do what I can to get some positive attention for the respectful, wonderful kids from that local high school who sometimes get blamed for minor incidents in the community. Alice, look what you've done. And that's from Frank Miller in Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, I love that story, you know, the simplicity of that playing catch. I remember when my son was born, I was just waiting for him to be able to be big enough to play catch. And so that's, yeah, and in relationships, it's so important, and it takes us back in time. We have a comment, and Ron from New Rochelle, New York. Hi, Peter and Eric. Where do you have Ron Guidry? He was 25-3 in 1978. That had to be a great year. No one has duplicated that in quite a while. Any thoughts on Ron Guidry's 78, Eric?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, he was obviously a very, very good pitcher who had some great years. I won't begin to, you know, talk about where he falls, you know, on the line of great pitchers, but it was, you know, it was an obviously great year. It makes me think, for example, about Denny McClain's 31-win season. And it makes me think about Juan Marichal, who, you know, despite having many great years, never won a Cy Young Award. And I remember seeing a statistic once at the Giants ballpark that said Marichal had more – 1 year, Marichal had more complete games than he did wins. And that just speaks a lot, I think, about how we use pitchers these days. I mean, Guidry was a great, great pitcher, no doubt about it.
You know, when we talked on the phone, I was – telling you, I've been watching past World Series highlights, and then the one of my favorite moments. Turns out you were at the game, the NLCS clinching game that put the Giants in the World Series in 2012. And in the film, they show Marco Scudero, I guess, in the ninth. The rain came start really coming down, and he puts his arms up, his face up, and it's a great. And then you're talking, you were there at that moment. Wow, what a beautiful moment in history, baseball history.
I was there with my daughter, my nephew, and my niece. If I remember correctly, it rained before the game. It didn't rain at all during the game until either the bottom of the eighth or the top of the ninth, and then the rain was torrential, like of biblical proportions. And our seats are eight rows from the field, just a little beyond you know, the infield dirt on the first base side. So, you know, we had a pretty good view of Scudero when he kind of put his arms out there and it was looking upwards. I mean, it was truly an amazing moment.
Everybody was getting soaked, but they didn't mind because their Giants were going to the World Series.
Did not mind one bit.
Do you have another story from your book?
Sure I do. this is actually one of the stories in the book, and we're a pretty big baseball family. My daughter works for the Giants in guest services. She's been the press elevator for decades. My son is in D.C., and his two-and-a-half-year-old daughter, he's already getting her to play baseball. And I'm very proud of the fact that I was able to take her to her first game about a month ago. I mean, she didn't really have a clue what was going on, but she had a good time. But this is a story that shows how it's very personal to me, and it shows how baseball has and always has connected our family. After over 50 years and attending hundreds of ball games, I had still never seen a no-hitter. I wasn't there on June 13, 2012, when Matt Cain stepped onto the AT&T mound, but I was watching on TV. My wife, Lynn, and I watched the whole thing, and our daughter, Rachel, was working at the park as usual for home games. As our collective favorite player, Matt Cain, was tossing more and more zeros, zero hits, zero runs, zero errors, and zero walks, the tension and anxiety began to rise in our household. From 3,000 miles away, four-way texts began with our son David, who knew we should be going to sleep but couldn't pass on the chance to watch history being made. Gregor Blanco's catch in the seventh was the first breathtaking moment. For the last play, a tough hop to Joaquin Arias, who had replaced Panda for defensive purposes, made him step backward, taking away any momentum toward first. Still, the play was made. Cain pumped his fist, and then came the phone call, a very brief one at 1 o'clock or so in the morning, from David. This was history, just the 22nd perfect game ever, and it was our favorite player who had accomplished this feat, and it was once again this magical game of baseball that had connected the four of us, from our home in San Francisco to the press elevator in the park to an apartment in D.C. to the pitcher's mound. 5 years later, Lynn and I got tickets to the last game of the 2017 season. Lynn likes to go to this game, Fan Appreciation Day, at which prizes are given away like water to racers in a marathon and players throw a ball into the stands after the game. But I went that day because I knew this was the last game Matt Cain would ever pitch. Several years of ineffectiveness, marked by the injuries that suddenly plagued this once impervious horse, had resulted in his decision at the relatively young age of 33 to hang him up rather than to try to keep pushing to regain a past magic. We knew he'd get that start one last time after half a season of doing bullpen mop-up work. He did, and he was magnificent, reaching back and pitching like the Matt Cain of old. And fittingly, befitting the term coined from his name, he got caned, receiving no run support. He pitched five innings, the last reputedly on fumes and adrenaline, gave up one run, and naturally took the loss. Still our guy, I thought, as today I watched the ceremonies inducting him onto the Giants Wall of Fame, and it still makes me a little teary when I read this story. He will be my last ever favorite player.
Beautiful, beautiful story. It reminds me of the I guess people hear all these, everybody's reminded of something. I was in Manila, Philippines, 1995 when Cleveland got into the World Series, and I got ended up having a three-way phone call. I didn't know what was going on. My brother in California, my sister in Boston, they told me, oh, we're going to the World Series. So we had that, kind of like you and your son, enjoying that perfect game. Todd from Salem, New Hampshire. Boston Red Sox collapsed in 1978. The Yankees erased a 14-game lead. Very bitter, but we paid them back, coming back. I think he's talking about 2004 when the World they were down 3-0 in the ALCS. Red Sox
right.
Down and won it. So any thoughts on 1978 Yankees Red Sox in 2004?
Well, you know, this goes back into my history a little bit. I'm from New York, and when I really started paying attention to baseball, there was only one team in New York. And when you're 8 years old or 10 years old, and you have Mickey Mantle running around center field and hitting home runs, I mean, what more could you possibly need? I was a Yankee fan until the day I was, well, pretty much until a few years after Mantle retired, when George Steinbrenner took over. And I don't particularly care for what he did to baseball. He changed the entire economics of it, and I'm just not wild about that. And at some point, I mean, of course, I was a Mets fan as well because I'm from Long Island. And at some point, I just became a Red Sox fan. I don't exactly know why. I certainly didn't do it knowing about the rivalry between the Red Sox and the Yankees, although I obviously found out about that later. Yeah, I remember that World Series when the Sox were down. That whole playoff run when the Sox were down 3-0 and then they swept the Yankees and then the next four, and then they went out, and I believe it was the Cardinals that they swept four in a row. And I think that was the year of Schilling's bloody sock. I'm a Red Sox fan. It's an unbelievable rivalry, similar to what the Giants and Dodgers have. And, I remember when the Sox played the Mets in 86. That really, I wasn't a Giants fan yet. I hadn't been out here that long. I didn't have kids that forced me to be a Giants fan. And boy, that the 1986 World Series, that was a tough one. But there are a lot of really great Red Sox stories in my books, including one from a guy named Jesse about to sign his book. That is just an epic story.
Denise from San Francisco. San Francisco Giants, three titles in a decade. Very impressed. Any thoughts?
Well, I mean, I'm a huge Giants fan, Denise. I live right here in the city as well. And I share your joy and your enthusiasm. And, you know, I wasn't even that upset this year that they, you know, that they were a mediocre team. And people say, weren't you disappointed? I said, not really, because they're a mediocre team that happened to have done phenomenally well last year, given their talent. And, you know, I don't really think a Giant fan can really complain that much for a little bit, because we've certainly had our share of successes. And, you know, Denise, you're in San Francisco. Maybe you'd like to come to one of the book readings I intend to do.
Frank from Germantown, Pennsylvania. My top five New York Mets gaffes: signing Bobby Bonilla, Mo Vaughn, Jason Bay, Paul Wilson, Kaz Matsui. Eric, I'm a Phillies fan. Any thoughts, Eric?
Well, I mean, you know, I was writing for a baseball article one time, a baseball magazine online, and I wrote a piece about what the worst trade in Mets history was. And I think that the most common thought from people was Nolan Ryan. I think it was Tom Seaver. I mean, but it depends how you look at it. You know, if you look going forward, then trading Ryan, of course, turned out to be a bad move. But I think the Mets had given him plenty of opportunity, and it hadn't happened. Seaver was probably, you know, beginning the downside of his career. I mean, he still had many, many effective years left, but they ripped the face of the franchise. Maybe the greatest player that the greatest homegrown player that the Mets will ever have. Certainly in 60 years, it's the case. When I think about gaffes, I'm starting to think about what this offseason is going to look like and whether they sign DeGrom, whether he wants to come back, whether they're willing to pay the money that I think is probably too much given his injury history. We'll see what gaffes come up in the future.
Gary from Warren, Ohio, went to the Cleveland Browns game last night and now hearing this great show, classic. Thanks so much, Gary. That was a good game for the Cleveland Browns. Eric, do you have another story for us?
I do. This one's a little bit more on the humorous side, kind of lighten the mood a little bit. And it's from a guy that I met on a cruise. We sat down next to him and he gave me this story. My wife Jane and I rank between a 5 and a 6 on the baseball fan scale. We like to watch games on television and try to attend a number of games each season if our favorite team, the Rangers, are doing well. In the summer of 1993, the Rangers were having a good season, attendance was up, and one of my all-time favorite pitchers, Nolan Ryan, speaking of Nolan, would be pitching against the White Sox. We loaded up and headed to the ballpark. We found our seats, and right in front of us was a young couple in their mid to late 20s from Australia. As we began to chat before the game, they told us where they had been and what they had seen. They were having an adventure, making friends and memories on their travels. Their mates in Australia had told them they needed to go to a baseball game while in the U.S., and this was the night. After several innings of strikeouts, walks, pop-ups, and grounders to second, the score was 0-0. The young man turned to his girlfriend in the typical Australian accent said, and I'm not going to do the accent well, but, you know, gives it a little flavor. Well, this is bloody boring. I understand why America is excited about baseball. His next step, buy a couple more beers from a nearby vendor. Rangers pitcher Nolan Ryan, a 46-year-old future Hall of Famer, was having a so-so game the first few innings. The White Sox batting coach is having his pitchers crowd home plate to protect the outside corner. Getting frustrated, Ryan started throwing inside. I'm guessing that some people on this call right now know what's coming next. Robin Ventura, an up-and-coming 26-year-old left-handed batter, came to the plate. As coached, Ventura hugged the plate, and Ryan threw a high fastball on the inside. Ventura jumped back, but to show he was not going to be intimidated, he set up even closer to the plate, and, you guessed it, Ryan threw another inside fastball. With a combination of Ventura's location and the speed of the fastball, Ryan hit Ventura in the arm, and the umpire sent Ventura to first base. After two or three steps toward first, Ventura decided to make his infamous charge to the mound. Ryan squared up, and when Ventura reached the pitcher's mound, Ryan grabbed him around the neck with his left arm and proceeded to beat the crap out of Ventura with his right. Both benches emptied. Mayhem ensued. The rest of the story is baseball history. At that exact moment, the Aussie exclaimed, "This is bloody fantastic. It's starting to make me feel homesick." He then said he understood why Americans love baseball. To this day, I am fairly certain this extremely excited young Australian believed that having a brawl during a game was a common experience. I did not want to spoil his baseball adventure. And that's from Alan Fowdy in Dallas, Texas.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that's a famous moment in history. And it's a funny take about the Australians seeing this at their first game. Do you have another story, Eric?
I do. What I was going to say about that story is, the stories aren't randomly put into the book. I obviously chaptered them based on common connections. Those stories are from a chapter called Triples. And in the chapter of Triples, there are three stories that are grouped by some thematic way. In this particular case, all the three stories are about watching a ball game, people from another country. This is from the chapter that's called My First Game. In truth, I'm not exactly sure if this is my story or my son's to share. I'm the baseball fan of the family. My husband is more of a football fan, although he appreciates the sport. I grew up rooting for the Phillies with my dad, who never stopped complaining about 1964, and I didn't care about the Cardinals until I moved to St. Louis in the 70s. That turned me into a loyal Redbirds fan. In the summer of 1980, I was pregnant, and as always, it was hot, humid, and not at all pleasant. I already had two children, aged 3 and 5 at the time. I wasn't feeling well, and I took myself to the doctor, who told me rather matter-of-factly that I had miscarried. My instructions, go home, stay inside, and rest. Not wanting to wallow in sadness, I decided that my kids should not be deprived of fun. Instead of following the doctor's orders, I took them to Busch Stadium for a game. The next day, I decided to get a second opinion on my medical condition. Lo and behold, I was still pregnant. Now, I'm not a doctor, but I choose to believe that it was the Cardinals that sustained the boy we named Ari. His first official game was before he was even born. And if that doesn't make Ari a lifetime baseball fan, well, I don't really know what would. I only wish the doctor, who was so cavalier regarding my condition, was alive to read this story and to see my 6-foot-5-inch tall son sporting his Cardinals cap, sitting with his similarly uniformed sons on his lap. And that's from Ellen Stein.
Wonderful story. Do you have another one?
I do. This is from the chapter that's called To Catch a Ball or Not. In July 29, 1990, I was at Candlestick Park with my wife, Diane. Our seats were 12 rows up from first base, an area we had to be ready to catch a foul ball at any time. In the bottom half of the first inning, I noticed a rather large fan carefully picking his way through the maze of legs, feet, beers, and peanut shells to get to his seat while carrying a large beer and a Polish sausage. Just as he was about to sit down, I heard the crack of a bat, and I looked up to see a towering foul ball headed his way. With one hand clutching his beer and the other cradling a Polish sausage, you could clearly see the panic and indecision on his face. At the last second, he set his beer cup and Polish on the cement between his feet and reached up to catch the ball, but he was too late to make the catch. The ball passed between his outstretched arms, and like a guided missile, scored a direct hit on the sausage, sending up a cloud of meat, mustard, and relish that thoroughly covered the unlucky fan and knocked over his beer. The ball scored about 5 feet to the left, 5 feet to the left, where another fan made an easy catch of the mustard-slathered ball. Needless to say, we all felt sorry for the poor fellow as he trudged back out the aisle, covered in the remnants of what should have been a fine ballpark meal. The Giants won that day, shutting out the Reds 4-0. This fan, too, was shut out from his lunch and a ballpark's greatest souvenir. And that's from John Aiken in Arizona.
Wonderful story. Do you have another one?
Yeah, do you want to hear kind of a really touching one or another funny one?
Touching.
The one I wanted to do. How does the love for baseball develop? You hear tales of Ebbets Field and cowbells, Comiskey Park and Nancy Faust's organ, eating your first Dodger dog, or being a bum in the bleachers at Wrigley. Be it Koufax, Ted Williams, Reggie's three bombs in 77, or Junior's backwards cap, something, someone, turned all fans' eyes for that first time, and baseball became their love. Mine? It was a little-known outfielder from Puerto Rico, Pepe Mangual, who played from 1972 to 77 with the Expos and Mets. My first live game started my love affair. A walk-off grand slam? Nah, he had no pop. Steal of home? He had speed, but nothing that dramatic. Game-saving catch? He was a decent center fielder, but again, no. On Friday, September 5th, 1975, a young, hopeful, but not terribly talented last place Expos team took on the first-place Pirates in a twilight doubleheader. It was my first time inside Jarry Park, which until then had been nothing but a dream castle on the TV set to a 9-year-old boy who'd started loving baseball in 1974. In the opener, Bruce Kyson was wild and didn't make it out of the first. Bob Moose, who would tragically die 13 months later, came in to toss 5 2/3 innings. This game went back and forth, and into extra innings we went. My young blood was pumping, and Jerry Park was rocking to the house organ with 15,000-plus fans on their feet as the Expos came up. Young side-arming Kenta Colby took the mound. Walks, wild pitches, and pass balls got McKinnon to third, Lyle to second, and Jerry White to first. The bases loaded for center fielder Pepe Mangual. Pepe entered the game as a pinch hitter in the seventh inning, hitting a nondescript 247. But what would a kid know other than it was the bottom of the 10th and the bases were loaded? Bruce Fleming was the umpire behind the plate. I cannot recall how many total pitches were thrown, but the count was 2-2 as Pepe fouled off pitch after pitch, every fan on their feet screaming, willing Pepe not to fail. I was in awe and wanted in that moment more than anything ever to win the game. It had been a horrific week in my life, filled with trauma. A young boy from small town Towanda, Pennsylvania, I went to visit my grandparents, not knowing my parents were splitting up, and that I'd never return home. I was to stay in Montreal, a new kid in school, with French-speaking folks hating English-speaking people and vice versa, mere months before a hated separatist government would come to power, forever changing the Quebec landscape. It was a terrifying experience for this small-town kid. None of that mattered right now. I just needed Pepe to win it for us. He worked the count full, then fouled off two more. I couldn't take it anymore. The next pitch was just a little outside, as Bob Uecker might say. Fleming motioned ball four, and the Expos mobbed Pepe as he trotted to first, and McKinnon walked home. A 4-3 Expo victory for that small, scared 9-year-old boy who would have to face his new life and surroundings once again on Monday morning. Nothing else mattered. I found love in Montreal, the love of the Expos, the love of Pepe Mangual, my new could-do-no-wrong hero, and my greatest new love, one that would last a lifetime without fail, baseball. And that's from Patrick Gutton in Sandpoint, Idaho. And this story has its own little peculiar meaning for me, because for whatever reason, my granddaughter calls me Pepe.
Okay, that's a beautiful story. Our guest has been Mr. Eric C. Gray, author of two books, Bases to Bleachers, a collection of personal baseball stories from the stands and beyond 2019, and Backyards to Ballparks, more personal baseball stories from the stands and beyond 2022. The time has flown by. We're out of time. Eric, do you have any final words tonight for our audience?
Well, I mean, I always would like to collect more stories because there might be a third book. If you're interested in the book or if you're interested in sending me a story, you can find me on my website, basestobleachers.com. You can also send me an email at eric.baseballstories@gmail.com. The books are available online. You can get a signed personalized copy directly from me. So feel free to send me an email or contact me through the website.
Well, it's been wonderful having you on the show. I recommend your books both very much. Really loved the one and almost done with the second one. Really tremendous. Give you all the credit in the world for writing them, and tremendous. Next week, we're going to have Bill North for the ninth time, the starting center fielder and leadoff hitter for the coolest MLB team of all time, the Oakland A's from the early 1970s. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again, Mr. Eric C. Gray.
Thank you, Peter, for having me. It was
wonderful.
Great.